School choice un-American? A social justice caucus is forming. Politicians picking college course content? What's going on here? You're about to find out. Let's bust some pencils.
This is Busted Pencils Radio, fully leaded education talk with Dr. Tim Slecker. Here's what's trending in education news.
Fake news alert, politicians protecting naive students. Thank the almighty heavens for a group of politicians that are going the extra mile to safeguard our college-aged children and drive public tax dollars away from professors and higher education institutions that teach our college-aged children. Even though it's not part of their job, nothing will stop this group of passionate protectors from working overtime to scour the syllabi of malcontent professors hell-bent on teaching college-age children such frightening things like the, quote, fact that some people, after the Civil War to boot, still think they are the target of racism. Imagine that. Racism post-Civil War. Only on campuses of higher education would our children be exposed to such subjective and anti-American rhetoric. And that's just the topic of racism. Professors across the country want to infect our college-aged children with all kinds of disturbing misinformation. It's been reported that the bullshit theory of man-made global warming actually holds a position of prominence with so-called climate scientists. Last I checked my Bible, it was pretty well stated that man had dominion over the earth. How about reports from other campuses where our college-age children are presented with alternative facts about the, quote, failure of trickle-down economics, the suggestion that a totally deregulated economy could have negative consequences for communities and people unable to get off their lazy asses and lobby their own politicians. Yes, thank God for the politicians that understand their true role as nannies protecting our college-age children from deviant, rebellious counterculture PhD zombies. You know, anti-America college faculty. Yes, instead of debating the use of tax dollars on such things as bridges, roads, and the continued building of golf courses in Arizona, our politicians have finally realized the reason we elected them, to provide a solid wall against reality and keep our college-aged children safe, from disruptive knowledge. Hey, you know, maybe when they're done with colleges and universities, our crusading politicians might want to look seriously into banning anything written by that creepy revisionist historian Howard Zinn. You know, I wonder what Matt Damon's mom thinks about politicians protecting the innocence of college-aged children.
Wait, what? You want to know what my mom would say? All right, well, just ask her.
Yeah, this whole question of that, you would have state lawmakers actually threatening to pull funding because they don't like a particular course. That makes me very nervous. And this is related to the whole discussion on the arts.
Mm-hmm.
Because the arts are a way of thinking outside the box, of looking at something in new ways and going to the edge of something, and that's what makes us critical thinkers. That's what stretches us and also contributes to our democracy in the sense that it reduces standardization and promotes diversity. And you've got a professor here. I don't know the professor. I don't know the course. It doesn't really matter. The fact is, professors have to be free to be able to invent and create in ways that make sense to them. The university has its own process for, you know, designing and approving courses, and that goes on there, and that's fine. But to have legislators, you know, threatening to influence what's happening in the university is very worrisome, because they have a whole different perspective. They come from more of a business model, and they have an expectation of education that's very different from the many creative professors who want to look at who want to look at education in very original, unique ways, and they should be. I mean, that's the purpose of one purpose of higher education. So, I don't like to think of what's happening actually in was in this particular situation at the University of Wisconsin is parallel to what's happening in all of education at every level. Because we've had an intrusion into education from people who are outside of education, policymakers, lawmakers, business people, who have a really different view of the whole nature of education from those of us who are in the field of education. And they've been imposing their point of view on us, and they've managed to do it to a great extent through the Common Core standards and other kinds of standards and through all kinds of mandates and policies and laws that have really inhibited education and narrowed the curriculum and taken the arts out of the curriculum and made it much more scripted and standardized. And that's what I see that they're trying to do at the university level.
See, I think you're giving this guy a little bit more credit, and I will just say this is Dave Murphy from Greenville in Wisconsin, who, in fact, I want to quote him. He said, you know, he's going to scour the university to make the university courses to make sure they're legit. That doesn't necessarily sound to me like necessarily a business model sense as much as it is a censorship threat that's, and he's got a decision as to what are legitimate courses and what are not.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the whole question there is, has he ever said what is legit to him? What does it mean?
I don't know, but if we're going to discuss anything dealing with race, I guess that's not legit, and taxpayers should not have to foot the bill for that.
See, I think this gets into the basic question of what is education? Because to my way of thinking and many other educators to explore as part of the humanities, issues of race, racism, living in a racist society, how it affects all of us and how we view ourselves and others, that's in education, it's essential that you do that. I mean, there's so much evidence that teachers perpetuate racism in the classroom in so many ways that part of teacher education is to really go through a process with teachers where they're examining their own racial biases and understanding themselves as human beings who've grown up in a racist society, whatever race they are. That's really essential to the work they can do as educators. Otherwise, they could perpetuate the status quo and create a lot of harm to children. So that I think that kind of course, has to happen. But I worry if someone's saying, I want to look at it to see if it's legitimate. That's what I mean. What is legitimate to you? Is it just that you, study data or numbers or history or...
Hey, the American patriotism, as long as we're, you know, Columbus discovered America and today we're all free, in between that, we got really great. That's a legit course there.
Yeah, so you're talking about the transmission model of education, where we just want to reproduce what's already happened and teach kids what's already known.
Right.
And we don't want to put them through a process of actually imagining or examining themselves and imagining what's possible in a different world. No, because that's scary, and that's something that gets out of our control.
This is Matt Damon on Busted Pencils Radio. Please stop bothering me and just ask my mom already.
Welcome to the show, Texas Superintendent, longtime advocate for public schooling, author of Fear and Learning in America. Texas, let's call him America's Superintendent, John Kuhn. Welcome to Busted Pencils.
Hi, Tim. Thanks for having me.
Hey, I appreciate you coming on, and you know, we're going to talk about a speech you gave. This speech you gave to the Association of Texas Professional Educators, which I understand is a union. I'm confused how an administrator, a superintendent, was actually talking to union people, because I thought you guys weren't allowed to talk to each other.
Well, you know, Texas is a little bit different. We're a right-to-work state, so it's not technically a union. It is an association.
Okay.
Is the terminology that's used down here. They do not have the right to collectively bargain. They can't go on strike. But what they can do is provide benefits for teachers, advocate for teachers. And it's an organization that I belong to. When I was a teacher, I've got three sisters that were all teachers. They all belong to ATPE, and my wife is currently a member of ATPE. So it's a good organization. And while it represents teachers, and I'm not a teacher anymore, I'm a superintendent. When it comes to a lot of the issues facing public education today, we're entirely on the same page.
That's great to see. I mean, it's good to hear, because I think a lot of people have that dichotomy of thinking, you know, administration, union, association, and the fact that those two wouldn't be together. And the idea, though, that you, again, we're talking about, you know, administrators, you typically come from being teachers who typically were in that association. So when I saw the speech that you gave and the way you talked to them, I wanted to first put that out there and say thank you for being an administrator who actually understands the need for associations and how important they are. The issue, though, that you really hit hard here, we've got newly elected President Donald Trump. He's been in office now for, a few months. We've got Betsy DeVos, the most underqualified Secretary of Education in the world. And both of them have been promising. Now, Betsy's been at this for a good 30 years, and Trump got on this. They've been promising us a choice-based voucher system. And your address to the Association for Texas Professional Educators, you talked about this not being much of an American value. And I want to put that out to you, John, and say, what do you mean? Competition, free choice, the market. What could be more American than that?
Well, I don't believe it is an American value, and I don't believe it's a conservative value, even though in a place like Texas, it's presented that way, because we have the same push coming from our state legislators and also our governor. But no, I don't believe that America was founded on a free market running, you know, completely rampant everywhere. Public schooling was a creation of our founding fathers and mothers. You know, they fought to have public schooling open to all children, free of charge and democratically controlled. You know, public schools are owned and operated by the American taxpayer. That's how they're funded. They're funded with our taxes, and public schools are controlled by elected, you know, board members. To me, that's what was the design of public schools, and it was designed that way so that local communities could have say in how their tax dollars were spent, in the educational quality that their children received. And the other thing about public education, the reason it's so important, and the reason I advocate in the first place, because I don't want to make noise. I don't want to, you know, put my name out there and be loud. But the democratization of our society happens in public schools. Our kids, instead of being in silos where the wealthy kids are educated over here and the poor kids are educated over here, the ideal of public education was we take all of our kids, we take our resources, and we educate our kids together. It's part of the speech that you referred to. I talk about education, public education, being real life. That's where kids mix and mingle, and that's where they live their lives.
Let's take the counter then, though. The voucher people are saying, okay, and in fact, you even referred to it. You said it's an ideal, so obviously we haven't got there yet, and maybe the ideal isn't working, and we're not educating students the way we should, and let's give vouchers a chance, because the public education system ideal is a flawed ideal, and if we're going to educate students, then vouchers are the way.
Well, yeah, that's the rhetoric, but it's based on falsehood. One of the things in the speech referred to recent research that has come out showing that matched sets of students that are applied for a voucher and half of them got in, half of them didn't get in. When they go back and look at the results of those kids, the kids who didn't get the voucher are outperforming the kids who did. So one of the lines in the speech, I think giving a student a voucher is like giving a struggling swimmer a boulder to help them swim. Vouchers are hurting kids. They're not helping kids.
I love that. In fact, we need to say that again. I put this in one of Busted Pencil's trending news for people to see this, that research that you cite. In fact, there's like three or four cumulative research studies that really do.
Yeah, there's three research studies that just came out.
Right. It's amazing, because it's like, it's not only, you know, occasionally we see studies where people say, look, they're not, you know, they perform about the same, so therefore it's not worth it. But here you have studies saying that voucher students actually perform worse. And as you just said, so giving a voucher to a struggling student is like giving a swimming person a boulder, or learning to swim person. So, yeah. What about this idea, though, when you talk about really, though, if we pull it down and take a look behind the curtain, it's about money.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's a business proposition. It's not an educational proposition.
How? how does somebody understand that?
Well, I'll quote Rupert Murdoch, who said the education industry is a $500 billion industry just waiting to be transformed. And so the reason that this push exists is not because the research shows that it's a better way to educate kids. It's a worse way to educate kids is what the research shows. But it is a better way for private individuals to make money. You know, I think investors and folks with lots of means, they're oftentimes looking for the next investment opportunity, the next bubble. The voucher movement would promise to convert what has been created and maintained and protected as a public trust that would turn that into a big business with lots of opportunities for people to open up franchises of schools and appeal to, you know, to try and appeal to students to get them to come so that they could, you know, charge the per pupil fee, the voucher fee for those kids. And, you know, a lot of people stand to make a lot of money if the voucher push is successful, but it's bad for kids.
Well, it's bad for kids. And so I, you know, it's hard for me and sometimes to even understand how we're still trying to have this conversation. Why does it take John Kuhn speaking to a large group of people laying this out? Why do we have to have a radio show when the research is absolutely clear that this is not good for kids? And as you just said, in fact, this is actually a way of taking away a public trust and taking those dollars and siphoning those off to, you know, and let's use the cliche, but essentially the 1% who want access to that money. It's right there in front of everybody, but yet we have to have this debate. I don't understand why.
Well, it's because there are a lot of folks with a lot of resources that are propping up pseudoscientific research. They're funding think tanks, they're funding websites, they're funding all sorts of efforts to push the narrative that public schools are failing and that vouchers are the answer. And that initiative, that movement, that big lie has been going on now for decades. And so that's what we're up against. And you know, Diane Ravitch has said many times, they have the money, but we have the people, because vouchers are very unpopular. In Texas, they've been put before the voters numerous times, and they failed every single time. And yet here they are again, you know, the zombie bill. They keep changing the name instead of calling them vouchers. You know, when they realized that was unpopular, they changed the name to education savings accounts and opportunity scholarships. And now they use the euphemism school choice,
right?
But it all really just means vouchers.
Well, and that's the brilliance of the people pushing this, though, is that their ability to rebrand and relabel it and push it out so that when you hear it, your first thought is, boy, that must be something I should get behind. You know, an education.
Well, the voucher lobby.
Go ahead.
The voucher lobby is the tobacco lobby of education. They don't have to be honest. They don't feel they have no compunction about misleading. They're trying to get a business deal off the ground, and they'll say what they need to say to make that happen. Unfortunately, you know, a lot of people who are not in this every day, they may not see the research that says, yeah, this is not effective. They may not see that. So it's up to people like you and like me to be vocal.
Oh, okay, so the tobacco, I've made that comparison occasionally, sometimes, well, usually about the testing companies that continue to sell tests that are problematic and that at some point, but people pushing vouchers, you know, we've seen it in the, quote, for-profit college realm. In fact, Trump University, mm-hmm. he had to pay and admit that he didn't educate people and had to pay a fine. If we start putting vouchers at this point, is there the possibility that it's just like the tobacco company, that possibly students that take these vouchers are going to be able to come back after the people and say, look, you provided me something that was not good for me?
Well, nowhere that vouchers have been tried have they been successful long term. We've seen, you know, in the country of Chile, we've seen in the country of Sweden, voucher programs, you know, Milton Friedman style voucher programs that have been implemented nationwide and have led to just catastrophic outcomes. And we see the data now that I referred to in the speech that you referred to moments ago, data from Louisiana, data from Indiana, showing that these large voucher programs that were pushed through with the backing of these, you know, large foundations like the Walton Family Foundation, Eli Broad, and all the others, we see that they have really devastating, terrible outcomes, and they impact kids. And when you're impacting kids and you're giving them a subpar education to further this business opportunity, you're hurting the future of your own state. You're hurting the future of our society, and that's something that should affect all of us. We should all be ready and willing to defend the future prosperity and peace of our state that we live in. So we have to oppose vouchers if we understand the harm that they do. And you know, the question is, a lot of the public doesn't understand the harm that they do because it's presented as a panacea.
Well, I like that, as you just put that, though, the idea, and the coming back all the way around to where I said, you know, I thought vouchers were an American idea. You come back and put in, say, you know, look, the ideal that we need to protect here is actually public schooling, because public schooling is what has the best interest for kids at stake, and a voucher has the best interest of the investors at stake. Knowing the difference between those two, then, an American value then would be to stick up for public schools. Is that a conclusion that John Kuhn would support?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's the patriotic thing to do, is to stand up for public schools, because you're standing up for a service that is owned and operated by the people, and that serves all the children. Public schools educate every student that lives in the school district, regardless of ability or disability, regardless of race, regardless of personal characteristic, home language. And that, to me, is a unifying thing to do. And voucher schools, they don't have to accept every child. Voucher schools, whether it's an existing private school that accepts vouchers, or whether it's some sort of new pop-up voucher school that comes into being because all of a sudden, you know, this new revenue source, which is, you know, it's state money that's going to be directed towards these schools. So there's no savings there for the taxpayer. But regardless of which kind of voucher school, an existing school that becomes a voucher school or a new voucher school, they don't have to accept every student that walks their door. They can say, oh, I'm sorry, we can't serve you because of your disability. We're not, you know, equipped to serve you. And they can have entry requirements, academic entry requirements, where they say, oh, sorry, you don't meet our minimum standards. They can turn kids away, and public schools don't do that. So to me, there's no question which of these two systems is more honorable and more noble and better for society and better for kids.
And then better for America.
Absolutely.
So
absolutely. Public schools have built America. You know, I mean, 90% of American kids through the decades have gone to public schools. And the same politicians who like to talk about in Texas how strong our economy is, we're such a wonderful state, everything's wonderful, they won't then say, and we owe it to our teachers who educated all these, you know, now adult Texans who went to public school, you know.
Right. John Kuhn, again, I'm going to put it, you're in Texas and you're a superintendent, but I'm going to still leave it at, you are America's superintendent. Make sure you check out his book, Fear and Learning in America. John, thanks for all you do. Thanks for busting pencils with us.
Absolutely. I look forward to talking to you again, Tim. It's great to reconnect.
Unfiltered, comprehensive, and of course, controversial. This is Busted Pencils Radio.
This week, Dr. Ricardo Rosso from the University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth, takes on the famous Alfie Cohn question. Ricardo, what are the schools our children deserve?
Yeah, well, Afi Khan, first of all, is a comrade. You know, I love his work, you know. But I would say that, you know, we have to sort of take a Zoom model. You know, there's obviously there are things that schools themselves can do to change things to make it better for students. But we can't talk about the schools our children deserve without talking about the society that our children deserve. So I think it's impossible for us to talk about one and not the other. So, I mean, when you live in a society where 1% of the population controls 45% of the wealth, primarily males, primarily whites, it's horrific. It's very hard for you to institutionalize this, you know, the schools that we really want. But, you know, fully funded schools, obviously. The fact that we fund our schools in this society with primarily state and property taxes, you know, is horrific. You know, it guarantees an unequal outcome throughout the country. With schools that have wraparound services, are schools that children deserve. I mean, psychologists in schools, therapists in schools, social workers, nurses. We have, you know, many urban spaces where you have one nurse for like three or four schools. I mean, it's horrific. So total wraparound services, teachers that, you know, are qualified in schools. Most of our teachers are qualified, but we have a situation where we have classes, teachers teaching 30 students per class. I mean, it's a horrific situation.
Educated educators talking education. Get the latest blogs from Peggy with a Pen, Lily's Pad, and Rebel Teacher now exclusively at BustedPencils.com. This is Busted Pencils Radio.
Welcome to Busted Pencils, our activist of the week, Haley Braden. Haley, how are you?
I'm doing well. How about you?
You're a teacher. You're a member of the union. But more importantly, you and some of your colleagues in the Denver, is it the Denver Teachers Union?
It's Denver Classroom Teachers Association.
The Denver Classroom Teachers Association, which is the larger, bigger union. A group of you decided to start a caucus. Now, first, what the hell is that?
Well, like we have caucuses within our federal government, for example, the Congressional Black Caucus would be one, basically like a political organization within some governing body that tries to convince the rest of the governing body to go in a certain direction and tends to agree on policies amongst the caucus. Our caucus is called the Caucus of Today's Teachers, and the reason why it's called Today's Teachers is because teachers these days, particularly since NCLB, are dealing with a lot of issues that teachers 20, 30 years ago weren't dealing with. And we feel like our teachers association, our union here in Denver, has done some great work to try to address those, but we feel that we have a lot more that we can do.
If the caucus is trying to influence the greater body to do something, I mean, what were some of the issues that, or issues that are coming up that you feel that the Caucus of Today's Teachers really want to push?
Well, I think one issue that has to do with our union and then also external factors is there's a perception in Denver, as there is in the rest of the country, that the purpose of the teachers union is to hide bad teachers or is a voice for people to use to complain. So we believe that we would like to change the public perception, and we think that we can do a lot more than our association currently is doing in order to change that perception. Also within the union, within the association, mm-hmm. we would like to make the organization a lot more proactive, responding to different education reforms locally and nationally, and also a lot more progressive and social justice minded.
Well, that's what I was wondering about that, you know, if it's a social justice because, you know, particularly, I look at Chicago, and we've done a lot of work on Busted Pencils, particularly with Karen Lewis, and understanding that the Chicago Teachers Union comes out of CORE, which is their caucus of rank and file educators, who started from, quote, a social justice framework to try to influence CTU. And as Karen always likes to say, I had no idea I'd be elected president. We thought there was no way, you know, that they were going to win. But there it is. Was that a model? Was that an influence for you guys?
Yeah, definitely. So there were a few of our caucus members who actually traveled to Chicago to meet with some of these people. We used Chicago as a model. Also, a teachers union in St. Paul, Minnesota, also Seattle. There's lots of places where great work is happening, where people are working for true social justice, not just throwing around the term because it's a trendy term to use.
Right. It's trendy. People throw that around, social justice. But, you know, break it down a little bit. So if you're a caucus trying to influence the greater union in Denver from a social justice framework, so what is it, what specifically, or what might be one or two specifics that would illustrate something you guys stand for that's a social justice frame?
So I think if you define social justice as creating a more equitable, just public education system for students, that would include things like good pay for teachers, good benefits for teachers, and good working conditions, which would end up impacting students. So having more social workers, nurses at school, more special service providers, because you can't expect improved outcomes or equity within schools if you're not providing the people who work in the schools with the means in order to do that. So I think some people are confused because they think social justice is just about making kids feel comfortable at school, which is very important, but it's also about teachers and making sure that teachers have the resources that they need in order to create these equitable conditions for kids.
I love the way you said that, because sometimes we get lost, and I agree with you, in social justice as just being creating equity for kids, and realizing, though, that, you know, one of the ways we create equity for kids is by making sure teachers have what they need to meet the needs of children. So there's how that equity comes in, and that's social justice. So it's, the bottom line is, how do we get what's best for kids? Well, one of the things that makes things best for kids are great teachers who have what they need.
Yeah, according to some data from 2015, the 2015-16 school year, Denver Public Schools, the district in which we work, our teacher turnover rate is 22%, where other nearby district with about the same number of students and about the same pay for teachers have turnover rates from 6 to 15%, depending on which district you're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
And we feel that if we're trying to create social justice for students, shouldn't that include recruiting and retaining the best possible teachers? So our turnover rate is really something that we'd like to work on as well.
Well, so there's a lot going on. It's the caucus of today's teacher. It's the new social justice caucus coming out of Denver. It's Haley Braden. You're one of the founding members of this caucus. Haley, thank you so much for busting pencils with us.
Yeah, you're welcome. It was a pleasure.
Unfiltered, comprehensive, and of course, controversial. This is Busted Pencils Radio.
They may be trying to ban him in Oklahoma, but not here. Each week we pay tribute to famous historian and activist Howard Zinn with your moment of Zinn.
If those in charge of our society, politicians, corporate executives, and owners of press and television can dominate our ideas, they will be secure in their power. They will not need soldiers patrolling the streets. We will control ourselves.
My thanks to Ricardo Rosso, Haley Braden, and John Kuhn. I'm Tim Slecker. Thanks for Busting Pencils.
Log on to BustedPencils.com for the latest trending news, blogs, past shows, and more. Subscribe to our podcast in iTunes and Google Play. And get daily updates by following us on Facebook and Twitter at Busted Pencils. This is Fully Leaded Education Talk. Busted Pencils Radio.